We are back for hour two of Random Play. I'm your host, Doug Cox. I'm coming to you from the Comox Valley on Vancouver Island in Canada. And wherever you're listening from, I hope you're having a great day and I hope you're enjoying the show. We're going to do something a little bit odd now just because this came up in my Random Play. I used to tour with actor and folk musician Ronnie Cox. We are not related, but I did get to be part of his band for a while. And he's a great folk musician. He's also a brilliant storyteller and, of course, one of the most recognizable actors from the 70s and beyond. If you're a fan of sci-fi, he was in many movies, including RoboCop and Total Recall, Star Trek, a bunch of stuff. He's probably most famous for his role in Dueling Banjos, where he played the guy who died in the canoe when he fell into the ocean and they pull his body up and his shoulders all dislocated. Do you remember that? If you remember the movie Dueling Banjos, you certainly will remember that. His character was called Drew, and that was one of the first movies that was filmed in real time and also where the actors, including Burt Reynolds, did all of the stunts themselves. Pretty impressive stuff back then. And Ronnie made a recording called Dueling Banjos, The Deliverance of Drew, where he told the story of Dueling Banjos. And I just happened to be lucky enough to have a copy of it. It came up today. It's quite a long thing. It's actually a double CD set, but we're going to listen to the first section. And if you're a fan of the man as an actor, or if you're a fan of the movie Deliverance, which of course is where Dueling Banjos came from, or if you're a fan of how movies are made, you're going to enjoy this. So here's Ronnie Cox with the Deliverance of Drew talking about his time in Dueling Banjos. I hope you enjoy this.
Dueling Banjos, The Deliverance of Drew by Ronnie Cox. In the spring of 1971, my life was about to change in the most unimaginable way in the world. My wife Mary and I were living in Rye, New York with our two small boys, Brian and John. And Mary was just starting the third year of her postdoctoral fellowship with Sloan Kettering. Mary had a PhD in chemistry from Georgetown University. And of course, I was a struggling actor and had done melodramas when I was in college and had worked at Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., and had done some off-Broadway and Broadway and Shakespeare in the Park, but was basically a struggling actor. So here we were in Rye, New York. And I heard about this movie that was being done, and I got a call from my agent to go in and meet with John Boorman, the director, on a film called Deliverance. And I've talked to Lynn Stallmaster, who cast the picture, and I believe I was the first actor they saw in New York, not because I was at the top of anyone's list, but because I was so far at the bottom of the list. I mean, I think they were going to start seeing people at 10 o'clock on a Monday morning, and they asked me to come in at 9 o'clock for a pre-meeting with Lynn to see if I was even worth seeing. You see, John Boorman's concept was to do the film with as many unknown actors as possible. So they came to New York looking for unknown actors, and God knows I was unknown. So anyway, I met with Lynn Stallmaster. I had read the novel, and he gave me a copy of the screenplay. And he must have liked me. He told me to go away to a coffee shop or something and come back in an hour. So I went away, and since I was already familiar with the novel, I read through it really quickly, the screenplay, and came back at 10 o'clock. And I met with John Boorman, the director, a wonderful little Irishman. He also produced the film, and we hit it off famously. So during the course of that week, they called me back in a couple more times to meet with John, and we read some scenes and talked about the role and talked about his concept of how he wanted to do the film. Now, in those days, preliminary meetings with casting agents and directors were scheduled in either 10 or 15-minute intervals. You literally went in and said hello and gave them a picture and a resume and spoke briefly, and then you were out of there. And one of the ways we used to keep score when you were a new young actor going in to meet on a movie or a television show or even a commercial was to see how long you could push that 10 or 15 minute limit. It sort of became a badge of honor. Even if you didn't get the job, you could go out and say, well, I spent the full 15 minutes in there. That became the ego boost for those of us who were struggling actors. What was really sort of incredible that day was that John Borman and I just connected immediately, beyond the pleasantries. And I ended up spending almost a full hour in there with him and had never felt so welcomed or felt like someone appreciated my talent quite as much as he did. He was fascinated that I had a musical background and that I had grown up in the Southwest, New Mexico, as opposed to the South. I don't know what difference that made to him, because this was a very Southern film that we were talking about, but John seemed to be mightily impressed with that fact, and with me too, and I got to spend that hour in there with him. And later that day, I got this huge, excited phone call from my agent going on and on and on about how they loved me and that I was going to get to come in for a callback. And it was a huge boost to my ego. Most of the time, my agent back then could hardly be bothered to answer my phone calls. But now, all of a sudden, without doing anything except having a meeting, I was being treated very differently. So they liked me. And within the next couple of weeks, they flew a whole bunch of us from New York out to Warner Brothers Studio in Burbank, California. They did screen tests for 18 of us. There were four groups of four with two people left over. We spent the whole day filming the big debate scene where they were deciding what to do with the rapist after they had shot him with the arrow. As it turns out, since there were four groups of four, they had two guys left over, and John Borman asked me to step in with them. So I was actually tested twice for the role. And out of those 18 people, I was actually the only one they liked. Well, that's not really true. Bill McKinney, who played the rapist, the guy that got shot with the arrow by Burt's character, he was actually testing for Burt Reynolds' role, the role of Lewis. So John Borman did actually like him. He just didn't see him in Burt's role. I was the only actor they liked for any of the four main guys. So I came back to New York and waited around for a couple of weeks. And I love this aspect of Hollywood. About two or three weeks later, they flew 12 guys from Los Angeles to New York and tested them there. The excesses of Hollywood, I suppose. Anyway, during that screen test, that's where they found Ned Beatty. Although he didn't actually come from California, he had come from Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., Ned and I had done about 30 plays together at Arena Stage. I had left, but he was still there. And they were testing people on a Saturday, as I recall, and Ned had two shows to do that day, a matinee and an evening show. So when Lynn Stallmaster called him up to see if he could get on a shuttle and come and test in the morning and then get back in time to do the matinee and the evening show, frankly, he was afraid he couldn't do it. But he did finally arrange to get a flight, got there very early in the morning to see John. It was kind of serendipitous because another actor friend of mine, a man named Barton Heyman, had met with John Borman during the previous week for the role of Bobby, which became Ned's role. John Borman had actually told Barton Heyman that the role was his, that he wasn't going to see anybody else because Barton had just so convinced him that he was the right guy for the role. But what had happened was that Lynn Stallmaster had remembered Ned sort of at the last minute and had cajoled him into coming into New York from D.C. to test. So in a way, by him going to all that trouble, John Borman, in all good conscience, could hardly refuse to see Ned out of courtesy to Ned and to Lynn Stallmaster. Long story short, Ned blew him away. It was sad for Barton that he didn't get that role, but wonderful for us and for the film that Ned did. Ned and I were such great good friends and had done all these plays together, and they didn't even know that we knew each other. So we were cast totally independently of each other. I was actually at that session as well, because John Borman had called me up and said, "Ronnie, I don't want you to feel like you're having to test again, but I would like to have you there to bounce the other characters off of." He wanted to match people up. So anyway, I was there at that test and did a couple of scenes with the guys there. So now basically they had found me and they had found Ned, and they were still absolutely not settled on anyone to play the other two roles. I think it may be the first time in the history of film that they found the two guys below the title before they found the two guys above the title. It generally doesn't happen that way. So Ned and I waited around for another 5 or 6 weeks while they were figuring out who was going to play those other two roles. And I have to tell you this right now. Every major actor in Hollywood wanted those two roles. I don't want to drop a lot of names here, but literally, this was 1971. And you name the absolute A-list, the AAA list of Hollywood actors, or New York actors, for that matter, and they all wanted to do this movie. One of the reasons that John wanted to do the film with as many unknowns as possible is he didn't want any character to be safe. If you saw Robert Redford or Paul Newman in a movie in the 70s, and it was a movie in which the characters were in danger, you were pretty sure, pretty damn sure, that that big star was not going to be in danger of not making it through. Now that I think about it, maybe those two are bad examples. If you think of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. So anyway, John Borman's whole concept was that he wanted all these guys to be at risk. Since this was such a harrowing movie, he didn't want any one character to be safe. So he really wanted to do and was prepared to do the film with all unknowns. Now, obviously, the studio would never let him do that. I mean, you got to have some name to hang the film on, at least in their estimation. So John's casting of this film, I think, was incredible. And his idea precluded him from using the older established big-name actors. If you remember, in the book, all the characters were in their early 40s. And John felt he wanted the characters to be younger. Now, I know there's a tendency by the studios these days on a youth movement to just cast everything younger, you know, apparently because they think it's sexier or something like that. But that was not his intention at all. His whole feeling about these guys being in their early 30s was, well, he had a very particular idea of why that should be. If you recall, we shot the film in 1971, and in 1971, we were just coming out of the Vietnam War, and there was this huge dichotomy in this country. John Borman felt that the most interesting guys around were the guys in their early 30s, because you see, guys in their 40s were already old enough to be a part of the establishment, and the younger guys, the guys in their 20s, were the part of the youth hippie movement. But he thought the guys in their early 30s were the guys caught in the middle. They weren't old enough to be establishment. They weren't young enough to be hippies. and they were the most confused and angst-ridden men in America, in his opinion. So he very consciously wanted our characters in that age group. Agents were submitting actors who were in their 50s, because in Hollywood in those days, if you were 55, you played 40. So they were submitting those guys to play these characters. And not only that, you see, this film obviously required some physical stamina, which precluded some of those guys, because this film was not going to be made in the traditional way where, you know, stunt guys did everything and then the actors came in for their close-ups. John really wanted us to be doing all of the stuff, and he was not interested in casting in the normal way the films were cast. There were to be no stuntmen in this film. We spent 6 to 8 weeks on the river learning how to survive class 4 rapids, boulders, cliffs, and snakes. And the four of us did it all. John Voight had just done Midnight Cowboy the year before, and he was obviously on his way to becoming a huge star. And so you can understand why they were anxious to have him in the film. Bert had actually been around for a while, but had not really established himself as a real force in films yet. He was more of a television star. He had done Dan August and 100 Rifles and things like that, but he was a television actor. And the year of Deliverance changed Bert's career dramatically. He did three things that year that changed it. He went on The Tonight Show for the first time, and people realized that, wow, this guy is funny. And he did Deliverance, and people realized that he really was this incredibly gifted actor. And last but not least, he did The Centerfold for Playgirl. And those three things all combined to make him a huge star, where within the next couple of 3 years, he became the number one box office draw in the world. So anyway, now we have the two guys above the title, as well as us two guys below the title. And we're going to go down to Georgia and make a movie. Thank you.
That, of course, is probably the most famous banjo song of all time at this point in time. Deliverance, the soundtrack to Deliverance, and the title track, Dueling Banjos. And before that, we heard a wonderful long story from Ronnie Cox, who was one of the stars of that movie, talking about what it was like to be cast into the movie. And Ronnie's a great folk singer as well. He tours around. He prefers to do gigs as a folk singer than he does to be a movie star these days. I was lucky enough to do some touring with him, and it was always fun because there was always a really interesting audience, people that were there either because of the movie Deliverance or because they were science fiction movie fans, which of course Ronnie was in a bunch of the really famous sci-fi movies, or because they were fans of Ronnie as a folk singer. And you could almost always look out into the audience and immediately tell why they were there. Lots of fun. We're going to go now and listen to a cut off of the Jamaica World Music Festival live recordings. This is Aretha Franklin with Daydreaming here on Random Play.
He's the kind of guy that would say, hey baby, let's get away, let's go someplace, where I don't care. You know it? He's the kind of guy that you give you everything and trust your heart, share all of your love till death do you part. I wanna be what he wants when he wants it and whenever he needs it. You know I do. And when he's lonesome and feeling lost, I'll be right there to feed it. Loving him a little bit more each day turns me right on when I hear him say, hey baby,
hey baby, let's get away,
let's go someplace. Sugar, can we? Well, I don't care. Yeah, 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 you know it.
Country music, he's the world, and it wouldn't be all it is without Merle. That he won't ever be gone, his songs live on. A fugitive and a branded man, mama tried to understand. Left us a lifetime of song, and he won't ever be gone. We were friends right from the start, and We shared some high times. I would sing some songs he wrote, or he would sing a few of mine. The music made us brothers till the end. And not a day goes by that I don't miss him. He won't ever be gone. His songs live on. Ramblin' fever and the way I am. Blue collar blues for the working man. We'll be singing him back home from now on. And he won't ever be gone. His songs live on. A fugitive and a branded man. Mama tried to understand. Left us a lifetime of song. He won't ever be gone. We'll be singing him back home from now on. He won't ever be gone.
Thing I remember knowing is a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound. No one could change my mind. Mama tried. The one and only rebel child from a family meek and mild. My mama seemed to know what lay in store. Despite all my Sunday learning, with the bad I kept on turning till mama couldn't hold me anymore. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but mama tried, mama tried, mama tried to raise me better. Every pleading I denied, that leaves only me to blame, 'cause mama tried. Dear old daddy, rest his soul, left my mom a heavy load. She tried so very hard to fill his shoes, working hours without rest, wanted me to have the best. She tried to raise me right, but I refused. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but mama tried, mama tried. Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause mama tried.
The late, great Merle Haggard, The Hag, with Mama Tried, which is one of his biggest songs. And before that, Willie Nelson with a tribute to Merle Haggard. Song called He Won't Ever Be Gone from a record called God's Problem Child. I'm not sure who wrote that. I don't know if Willie did or not. Aretha Franklin with a very rare live recording of the Jamaica World Music Festival and a beautiful version of her tune called Daydreaming. I'm Doug Cox. You're listening to Random Play. If you want to reach me, you can email me DougCoxMusic@gmail.com, or if you simply want to find out what I played on today's show and you want to know how to spell it, so you can go find it, you can check out my playlist at DougCox.org. Click on the Random Play header and it'll take you to this week's show and some previous week's shows as well, which you can listen to. You can also subscribe on Patreon and receive Random Play weekly in your mailbox. Or if you're listening on one of the fine independent radio stations which is playing this radio show, I would encourage you to keep listening there, and please support anybody that is encouraging the promotion of independent music. It is so important now. We're going to go now and listen to Linda Thompson, who, of course, used to be married to Richard Thompson. She put out a beautiful record called Won't Be Long Now, and this features their son, Teddy Thompson, as well, with a tune called Never the Bride.
At 16, I fell for Billy. He was a tall and bonny youth, a friend to every pretty girl, but a stranger to the truth. He swore he loved me dearly. I swore I'd not upset him, but he said he couldn't marry me. His wife would never let him. His words were true. He worked the docks at Liverpool, loading steamers bound for Spain. But his heart was young and restless, and he soon sailed away.
the spring fever just way over my head. Stealing from Mobus, picking up all my time. It's playing Russian roulette with my mind. None of my business, baby, is just what's going on. Somebody throws me a bone. I went on the limb now, and nothing seemed to rhyme. It's playing Russian roulette with my mind. I think that you've caught on. Yeah, that you've been using all. I've got to see Dr. Jones. If John Rose, you're working, everything will be fine. Stop playing Russian roulette with my mind. It's not easy, baby, when everything starts getting out of control. Hang on to your hat now. Hang on to your soul. Don't worry, baby, I wanna throw you the line. They're playing Russian roulette with your mind. There's too many hustlers, and I've been here before. None of them really know just that you are. Everything gets contracted and space gets confined. A free Russian roulette with your mind. A free Russian roulette. A free Russian roulette. A free Russian roulette with your mind.
She sang jazz in the 50s, wrote songs in the 60s, and acted in 75. When she crashed in Paris and died for a minute, she was full of herself and full of the future. And she was beautiful. She was radiant but broken, for she knew her soul had gone ahead to hold the right door open. Oh, she kept on singing and dancing and ringing the same bells that she rang before. She wasn't looking for beauty now. She was looking for the door. And we all looked for it in darkness together. And we looked for it in light. And we looked for it in worlds that only existed at night. Then one day she went to pieces with the whole world looking on. Now she's just another loser on beautifulloser.com. So the world kept turning, and we got into learning how to be all grown up and tough. And we all turned into doctors and lawyers and stuff. But it was good to know she was out there being free. Someone bad was dreaming up beautifulloser.com. She was beautiful. She was radiant but broken, for she knew her soul had gone ahead to hold. She's back in the business with a smaller apartment and a whole new set of dreams and a small-time agent who's guaranteed to get a face on a million screens. So she went to a few auditions, but she couldn't get a part. They were always after a younger woman, someone full of herself and full of the future. But this weird little kid, he kept coming around and banging on the door, saying, "Lady, I work for this website. I know you'd be perfect for, but they won't care about your redemption, and they don't allow wounds to heal. The customers like you broken, it's a take it or leave it deal." Now she lies in the shadows and dies for the camera, and she'll do what you want her to do whilst trying to hang on to the memory of a young girl so full of herself and full of the future. And she was beautiful. She was radiant but broken, 'cause she knew her soul was up ahead, holding the right door open. So she filled her room with flowers, and she wrote to everyone, but she never said a single word about beautifulloser.com. She said she was living in India where the air was clear and still. Every soul's got a private door that you can pass through at will. Then she took down all her mirrors and broke them one by one. Well, I was busy getting rich off beautifulloser.com. And her heart was aching, her hands were shaking, and she knew her soul was out there waiting. So with the whole world looking on, she put a shotgun in her mouth on beautifulloser.com. And she was beautiful. She was beautiful. She was beautiful. She was so beautiful. She was beautiful. She was beautiful. She was beautiful.
Kind of a historic recording there for those of us who are fans. That was Graham Goldman and Kevin Godley, both of the band 10cc, from the early days of 10cc. They got together fairly recently and made a record together, and that song was off of that record. It was it's a beautiful album. It's called GG/06LP1, and the tune is called BeautifulLoser.com. Graham Goldman and Kevin Godley. Not usually a team. I mean, Kevin Godley and Lil' Cream became really famous after their time with 10cc as a duo in both the video and the music worlds. But Graham and Kevin together is kind of rare and very cool that they made that record. I'd recommend you go find that one. Van Morrison, The Unrecognizable Sounds, from the record Days Like This with Russian Roulette. And opening up that set of music, Linda Thompson with her son Teddy Thompson from the record called Won't Be Long Now with Won't Be Long Now, the title track, of course, for that record. I'm Doug Cox. You're listening to Random Play. We got time left for just a couple more songs today. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We're going to go to Bruce Coburn now and listen to a song called Parnassus and Fog. The great Bruce.
Thank you. met a girl and we ran away. I swore I'd make her happy every day. And how I made her cry. Two faces have I. Sometimes Mr. Rock is sunny and wild. Oh Lord, I love to see my baby smile. But then dark clouds come rolling by. Two faces have I. One that laughs, one that cries. One says hello, one says goodbye. One does things I don't understand. Makes me feel like half a man. Night I get down on my knees and pray. Our love will make that other man go away. But he'll never say goodbye. Two faces have I. Last night I kissed you neath the willow tree. He swore he'd take your love away from me. He said our life was just a lie. Two faces have I. Well, go ahead and let them try. Two faces have I. One that laughs, one that cries. One says hello, one says goodbye. One does things I don't understand. Makes me feel like half a man.
That was a fabulous bluegrass band. Used to call themselves Salamander Crossing. I don't think they're around anymore. From their record called Passion Train with Two Faces Have I. Bruce Coburn from Small Source of Comfort before that with a lovely instrumental, Parnassus and Fog. I'm Doug Cox. You've been listening to Random Play. Thanks so much for listening. Once again, if you want to drop me a note, DougCoxMusic@gmail.com is a way to reach me. I'm going to leave you with a track off of a classic record, Jerry Douglas and Peter Rowan together. The record is called Yonder, and the song, is called Can't Get There From Here, which is true. We'll see you next time around on Random Play. Thanks for listening.
Lonesome, lost and all alone. I stopped by an old farmhouse to see where I was near. Farmer grinned and said to me, you can't get there from here. Can't get there from here. Can't get there from here. Farmer grinned and said, son, you can't get there from here. I was feeling mighty hungry, so I stopped in for a bite. But when the door was opened, I realized my worst fear. Standing in her bathrobe, he said, you can't get there from here. You can't get there from here. Can't get there from here. A stranger in her bathrobe said, you can't get there from here. Feeling sad and lonesome. lonesome, I was feeling kindly blue. I went to see old Bill Monroe to ask him what to do. He said, don't go searching far away for something very near. That ain't no part of nothing, boy. You can't get there from here. Can't get there from here. Can't get there from here. That ain't no part of nothing, boy. You can't get there from here. Can't get there from here. Can't get there from here. Don't go looking yonder. Can't get there from here.